All-speed traction control, active suspension, stability enhancement, power retractable hard top, variable valve timing, audio system enhancements, three-spoke steering wheel, longer wheelbase, distinctive styling, high performance, finesse, raw power, rugged, liberating, truly responsive, every look, every touch, every time, simple bold strokes, new standards for toughness, strength, safety, stability, comfort and style, power on demand, world-class performance.
We're talking about car crashes. So, what's the effect? What stays? What do you remember from being in the car on that particular day? Keep in mind, this sample is skewed. We're only talking to the survivors.
It woke me up to an awareness of how fragile we are.
I went in a couple, 3 or 4 days later to make a cup of tea, and I was going, tea, how do you make tea? Water. Oh, there's something, I can heat water in that. That's a teapot. Now I need a cup.
So it really shattered my confidence for a while and helped me to remember that I'm just a little tiny piece in the big, big picture.
I ended up in debt about $38,000 after the insurance finished, and which went up to $60,000. It just destroyed me financially.
I relived the accident over and over in my dreams, and of course, in my dreams, it got worse, you know, that I had killed some poor girl, you know.
And to me, it was the story of the skeleton woman being picked clean to the bones. It was like my whole life just was shattered. And then I had to pick it up piece by piece, and it's taken 10 years. In the skeleton woman, all the flesh goes off the bones, and then it has to be sung back onto the bones. I feel like that's what I've been doing, is just kind of singing myself back onto my bones and reclaiming life, but it'll never be the same.
It was like there was a thickness, a gel, a fuzziness between me and reality until my body had processed the fears, all the adrenaline, all the cortisol that got flushed through my system.
There's great compassion and empathy for a few days, or maybe a few weeks. And then after a while, if you're still recovering or you're still suffering, there's a little bit of, come on, get over it. You know, this happens. What is the statute of limitations for recovering from these things?
Well, I came out a bit humbled, realizing how vulnerable, you know, I was.
And so he was paralyzed, and his back was broken in two places and paralyzed as a result of that accident. And because of the fact that he was, even though it was a single car accident, it was determined that he had alcohol in his system, of course, in the emergency room. And he was charged with drunk driving. Now, this happens to lots of people, but my husband was an elected official. In fact, he was the district attorney in the county where we lived. And I remember standing in the waiting room of the intensive care unit the morning after his accident, after the doctor, it was about 5 o'clock in the morning before they came and told me he's paralyzed permanently. And the doctor who told me that was like most doctors were then, and many still are. He just was very matter-of-fact and just said, I'm sorry that your husband is paralyzed from the chest down, and he will be the rest of his life. This cord's completely severed. There's no hope. And that's basically what you're dealing with. And walked out.
So later on in life, when I subsequently became a driver myself, I drove like a maniac because I was so eager to get back out of the car. I was like, I would drive so fast because I just wanted to get there and get out of the car. And so I'd be just super hyper vigilant, my eyes wide open and my instincts at maximum, and just getting there absolutely as fast as possible so I could park it and get back out again onto like sand slick ground.
In the days that followed, again, it was this feeling of elation that I was alive, because the line for me between being here and not had been so fine.
What surprises me is how long something like this lingers in your life. None of us were killed. None of us were permanently injured. So it surprises me how an event like that
can continue to linger?
I'm actually doing well. I dislocated a finger on one hand, and then I broke my hand on the other. Like I said, my tongue is numb. My whole head is numb. I have a nice scar now that runs from my hairline and right down the middle of my forehead to my brow, then cuts under my eyebrow, then all the way over to my temple. And it's very dramatic, and I just have to think of a really good story to go with it rather than being whacked on the highway. You know, like being in a knife fight. Because unfortunately, being whacked on the highway, everybody's accepting that as status quo. And nobody really thinks about it, otherwise things would change.
We forgot something. Okay, 42,000 dead last year. So how many people, there's probably no statistic on this, how many people got the phone call?
I got a phone call. Mom, Koya's been in an accident. It's pretty bad.
And I just remember him getting the phone call. And, you know, someone just called him and said, Sean is dead.
So she takes the phone out to Kate, and Kate's laying there asleep and gets the call. And, you know, this is Marvin Trotter, and Max just been in a terrible accident. And the phone went dead.
When I was a freshman in college, my roommate's brother was a deputy sheriff, and he would take us out some nights and just take us around, and I was going to go, and my roommate was going. And I wasn't feeling really well, and I said, well, you know, maybe Jennifer wants to go, my like best friend across the hall. So I went across the hall, and I said, Jennifer, do you want to go out tonight with Sophie and her brother and his friend? Because I'm just feeling kind of, I'm just not up for it. And so she said, oh, that's great. I'd really love to go. And they left, and I lay down for a while, and then somebody knocked on my door, said that there was not a party, but kind of a get-together at this men's dorm. So I went out. And we were out past hours, but I was with a sophomore, and so she had a key card to let me into the dorm, so I was out past hours. And we were sitting at this men's dorm, which we were at illegally, because there was no visiting in men's dorms yet. And the phone rang, and it was one of the resident advisors, and she asked for one of the upper-class women, and this woman, Vera, came back, and she said, we have to go back. And I said, what happened? I said, and I thought that they had just discovered I was gone, and, you know, and I was in big trouble. And I said, I'm in trouble, aren't I? She said, no, it's okay. She said, but we have to go back. So we walked back to the dorm, and we came in, and the resident advisor and all the resident, everybody was up. And they were all in the living room. And the resident advisor sat down next to me, and she said, I have to tell you that there's been a very bad car accident. And Jennifer is dead. And Sophie's very seriously injured. And so was her brother. The other guy just had some bruises. She was sitting in the front seat, which is where I would have been sitting. And there apparently had been a sports car driving at a very high rate of speed. They think that I think alcohol was involved. And he had been coming down the wrong side of the highway. And Sophie's brother swerved to try to get out of his way. And I think the natural thing is to swerve left. And he swerved left. And of course, the guy was going too fast. And the guy just hit the passenger front seat. Well, hit that side just head on. And so Jennifer was buried. She was from Ohio, and we drove for the funeral. And I just felt terrible because I felt like I was responsible for her being in the car, and I guess that
All I can think is that it wasn't my time, and I don't know why it wasn't my time, but I guess it just wasn't. So that was, we were driving, I don't know where we were going. Somebody was taking me someplace about probably a week later on this little country road near the school. And we passed by this, it was like a salvage yard. And I saw this little sports car sitting in the front at this body shop. And I think it was the car that that was in the accident with my roommate and her brother and Jennifer. And I looked at it, and there was nothing left of that car but the trunk. You know, it was just the back end of the car was there. The front end of the car was gone. It was awful.
Well, about 3.5 years ago, almost four now, I happened to be at a theater workshop and got home from it to a card on the door from the Sebastopol Police Department. So I went inside and listened to my phone messages. And the first message was from somebody who identified himself a stranger. He said, "I you don't know me, but your son and his father have just been in a serious car accident, and here's your son." And so, of course, my soul just flew up and out for a split second, and then, you know, and then I realized that Cello was obviously okay because I heard his voice, shaky, but there, and just said, "Mom, you need to come down."
Well, I remember we got up in the morning and we were going to go down to my dad's property in about maybe an hour away. We were listening to a tape called Happy Days, and we were like laughing and talking and stuff, and then he said this is a really good song, and then sort of stepped on the brake really fast, and I was wondering what happened. And I looked over and I saw like a gold car spinning out that hit our car, and we sort of
So the next message was from the hospital administrator or the social worker, so I called her back, and she told me that my former husband, Cello's father, had passed away in the accident. I just couldn't believe it. It was just a few days after school was out. And so they had plans to spend 3 weeks together in Los Angeles where his dad was working. And this was about 5 days after Cello had arrived. And they were on their way to a birthday party.
Kind of a, I don't know if you can say like a blurry sound. A screechy, and just like everything banging together at once. And then when we stopped and I called out like a couple times, and I noticed that the music was actually still playing for a little bit afterwards. And I was upside down basically, so I unbuckled my seatbelt and kind of thudded down on the back of the seat, and the only really way I could get out was through the window, so I did that.
Cello was luckily wearing a seatbelt. His dad wasn't. The puppy that was in the car was thrown from the truck also. This was a puppy that had just been, Cello's dad had just gotten it for him. So the puppy was also thrown from the truck. But anyway, he was able to climb out. He saw his dad lying on the highway and started walking toward him.
And I looked over and I saw my dad, and then the guys came over and asked me, like, "Are you okay?" and everything, and all that really happened to me is that my nose was bleeding and I had a scratch on my finger, and I said, "Is my dad going to be okay?" And they said, "Yeah, he'll be fine. You can see he's even talking." And at the time, I looked over and his mouth was sort of flipping up and down. And the police were around them.
And some strangers who had stopped took Cello and kind of cared for him there, didn't let him get too close so that the paramedics could work with his dad. And it was also fairly gruesome.
He was on his back, and I got into the ambulance, and I remember actually sort of enjoying the ambulance ride because I was in shock. I didn't really get that that would happen. It was cold, and they told me all about what the gadgets in there are for, and I learned later that he wasn't talking. They were shaking his foot, and his mouth was moving up and down. And we had gotten the car fixed, like, the day before. It was a blue Ford truck. We had gotten it fixed the day before. I didn't expect, I thought maybe he'd have some bone broken, but I didn't expect anything like that. So then, I didn't know any numbers or anything. We called my mom, but she had gone to a play. I don't know how they got the number, but they called the family in LA, and their two daughters, their son and their daughter came up, and we just sort of sat in the bed.
And I remember the sound that came from my body when I learned that he had been killed. It felt like not a human sound almost. But she brought me back really quickly because I needed to make some decisions about Sela. Sela had not been told at that point. And she was concerned that too much time would go on beyond that, you know, without him really knowing.
I heard it and I sort of just, like, what? I don't get it. And then I just cried for like maybe 5 minutes, but it was just sort of shock. They said something like, I've got something to tell you, and after that I'm going to leave you alone so you can do what you like. And first they said that your friends are here, and then they told me, and yeah. I was 9.
I was, you know, from afar, I was instantly trying to get to Los Angeles. And I thought maybe I shouldn't drive myself to the airport, given the circumstances. And so I called a friend to drive me, and I could have done a better job. She took forever. So I was able to make it into Los Angeles that night. Everything else evaporated in my life, and whatever needed to happen was all that was really on my mind. It was both grief, and I think my particular reaction to grief is to do. And so I had, you know, I was already making lists about how we should, you know, what we should do at the memorial service, and, you know, just kind of crazy things like that. And as it turned out, there was not much I could do because his father and I were actually divorced. We spent a week in Los Angeles, and I just let everybody else take care of things and just being with Sela and working with him. He remembered amazing amounts of detail, and so I just kept taking notes of that to keep. He remembered the song that was playing in their car, which was Bruce Springsteen's Glory Days. He remembered the last thing that his father said to him, which at the moment I can't remember, but he remembers, you know, those last words, and they were sweet and tender. Something about how much he loved music, maybe. He remembered that the map in the truck had, in the accident, had sort of blown open and was completely open and covering the windshield. I knew that I needed to find a therapist to work with Sela, and I knew it needed to be somebody specific to, or some sort of work specific to trauma, because what was happening for him every time we would get in the car subsequent to the accident, it was just hard for him to be in the car a lot of the times because he was so nervous.
I wouldn't say it's like traumatized me for life or anything, but it got me working with a really cool therapist, and yeah, we called her Toy Doctor because she let me play with toys to express my feelings instead of like, how do you feel about that or anything.
The day before the accident, I had had this overwhelming feeling just all of a sudden while I was driving. I had this overwhelming feeling of, wow, I am so grateful that this man has been in my life. And I feel such love for him. Not the kind of, you know, let's get back together love, but just such deep, soulful love for him. And this is such an unusual feeling to come over me that I might want to share it with him. And so the next morning, which was actually effectively only a couple of hours before the accident, I did. I think he called, and we were just discussing details, arrangements, and whatnot, and I was able to let him know that, just let him know how much I loved him and how, you know, important he had been in my life. And he was really taken aback. His dad was taken aback to hear this from me. Usually didn't hear things quite that sweet and tender, and was, you know, a little astonished. And I think the last thing he said to me was, you know, what a great parent he thought I was. You know, so we had this opportunity for last words, even though we didn't know it at the time, which was kind of amazing.
Well, our dog, we still have the dog that we'd had her 5 days, maybe we had her. And when she flew out the window, some guy in a convertible just picked her up and brought her to an animal shelter. And we thought that we wouldn't see her anymore. And we went there and there she was, and she was really glad to see us, yeah.
Well, when I was a young lad, I'd say I had a number of them, to the point that my insurance agent out here was looking at me kind of cross-eyed for a while.
We spend so much time in our cars that we don't like to think about what the statistics are in terms of car fatalities. I tend to drive like a little old lady. People don't really enjoy being behind me in traffic. People hate to drive with me. But on the other hand, it just scares me to death when I'm driving with a typical California driver. Even women my age, they've got this testosterone deal going, you know. God has forbid that they're not the first car in line. You know, it's like some key part of their body's going to drop off if they're not out there leading the pack.
I drive very, very conservatively. It strikes me as the only sane way to drive around a lethal weapon.
I've been in so many accidents and I've never been injured. There's 13 that I can remember the very specific examples of. When I just say that, people are like, oh, you must be a horrible driver. And I'm like, well, no, I know really horrible drivers. And I actually tend to be one of those people that everyone's like, I feel really safe when I drive with you. But by the same token, I mean, maybe part of it's that I grew up, you know, right near Detroit. And it's very like so much a car culture that, you know, cars really spell independence for a lot of people. And for me, you know, definitely.
And then in the years since I was in those accidents, you know, I've pondered the ecological and social and political ramifications of automobiles, why they became the primary form of transportation in the world, what the manufacture, the distribution of automobiles does, what it's caused to the geopolitical situation in the world, and the fact that we've got global warming. There are bigger questions to be contended with when you think about the implications of the automobile.
The Solstice, the Envoy, the Vanquish, the Continental, the STS, the Knights of Alex.
Century, Lucerne, Rainier, Rendezvous, Escalade, Avalanche, Astro, Chevette,
Colorado, Equinox, Express, Impala, Silverado, Tracker, Trailblazer,
Uplander, Freelander, Outlander, Highlander, Venture,
Well, I just remember as a little girl going to birthday parties out at Playland at the beach, and my very favorite activity out there, certainly much better than the skating rink or the lady who laughed or all that, were bumper cars. I love bumper cars. And I thought, well, maybe that doesn't bode too well, but, you know, it was probably my earliest driving experience, and I did very well at bumping into people. I mean, I didn't go from across the room and try to ram somebody. Yeah, but I, you know, I was probably 5 feet away or something like that, and it was just really fun. Yeah, I was in control, and which I wasn't very often as a child.
You've been listening to Car Crashes, interviews by Conrad Bishop, music and engineering by Elizabeth Fuller, produced by The Independent Eye. The voices you heard were Robert Bailey, Phyllis Beattie, Kathy Cabral, Laura Combs, Frank Doerr, Cindy Emsch, Gavio, Bonnie Gray, Orlin Harris, Sally Holtzman, Elizabeth Johnson, Cody Kirkham, Erica Lann Clark, Mac Magruder, Sarah Marshall, Joan Mueller, Dawn Pillsbury, Linda Puig, Bertha Riley, Becca Robbins, Lilith Rogers, Evelina Rose, Sarah Savitz, Sela Shalom, Ayn Shore, Victoria Slindflor, Rima Snyder, Susan Strasberger, Linda Terry, Sam Webster, Michael Welch, Gore Yaswin, and your hosts, Conrad Bishop and Elizabeth Fuller. Listen to all our past shows at www.hitching.org.
My blood pressure did stabilize. It was stabilized by the time we got to the hospital. And then, of course, there was the frantic scene of any car crash victim arriving into an emergency room. So they rush me in, and of course I work there. I know everybody in the emergency room and in the ICU. So they rush me in, and all of a sudden it's like, oh my God, it's Bonnie. Oh my God, oh my God, it's Bonnie. Did you know it was Bonnie? No, did you? So there was all this franticness about that. And as is common, you know, they rush you into a room and they immediately strip you completely naked in your birthday suit. And I'm like, oh, I'm lucid, I'm aware, and I'm completely naked on this table with my coworkers. Okay, well, I just need to surrender. There's nothing I can do about this.
You've been listening to Hitchhiking Off the Map, produced by the Independent Eye. And we're very sorry to say that this is the final program of the series. Hitchhiking Off the Map is coming to a close, as it is.
Yeah. It's literally been financed by our savings and our vegetable garden and some generous donors all over the country, but not enough of them, and we can't afford it.
And our five cats.
Five? Oh. Where's the one I don't know? That one's a raccoon. But we will continue to do specials and new pieces on CD for the Hitchhiker's Audio Library. There are lots of stories still to tell.
You can still listen free on our website, www.hitching.org. If you don't know how to do web audio, we'll tell you how right there. But all 3.5 years are archived there.
Plus our spoken word CDs. Check them out as holiday gifts. Family Snapshots, Life Journeys, Nativity, Inanna, Love Tales, many others.
www.hitching.org. We will also be posting there a shorter monthly audio feature and our schedule of live performance events. Every final Friday of the month in the Sebastopol area, we do an extraordinary, beautiful community performance circle, the Hitchhiker's Cabaret Cauldron. This month, it's Friday, December 30th. And in February, Elizabeth performs a new solo show, Dream House. I'll be directing a production of The Hobbit at Cinnabar Theater in Petaluma. And this coming summer down in Berkeley, we're collaborating with Shotgun Players on our new play of Norse mythology, Ragnarok. So find out about all that stuff on the website, www.hitching.org.
We have so many people to thank, we'll just take a minute. Our stalwart stations, KRCB, KPFA, KWMR, KFCF, KZYX, KZYZ, and all the people there who've been so kind and supportive of the show.
Thank you.
Thank you. And to our maestros of web audio, Lou Judson and Colleen Burrows.
Thank you.
Our webmaster, Eli Bishop. Thank you.
And the countless people we've interviewed, our audio drama actors, the many people who have donated to help keep the show on the air for 94 episodes. Thank you.
If you're a listener, we'd really love to hear from you. Just a few words about how you've liked the show. Email info@hitching.org and let us know what you think. We haven't given up the idea of resurrecting the show at some point if we can find a way to do it.
Or we'll come bursting out of the cocoon with wings. So let us hear from you, info@hitching.org. And one more personal thanks, and that is to Elizabeth, who as editor has done wonders in slicing coherent features out of hundreds of hours of tape and has spared our listeners thousands of and-ahs and pops and burps, and with her music has given an enormous life to the show, and with her food has sustained me. So, and thank you for listening. So this is Conrad Bishop.
And Elizabeth Fuller.
Peace and
joy.